the Living 1982 podcast. Were you into the punk scene in the very early 80s or someone who discovered the genre along the way? Well, we're doing some deep diving into the Seattle punk scene and sharing the story behind a band that was very short-lived but made a lasting impact with members going on to being in some of the biggest bands in the world. Their debut album was never released back in the day but is finally out now. This is the story of The Living.
I'll give a little history to the Living for you guys. Just a little brief history.
Great.
Todd had brought up Chris Utting, Chris Crass, as he was known.
Yeah.
So the original version of this band was getting Todd in. Me and Chris Utting were playing guitar. And we'd switch and drums, so we'd switch off like halfway through the set. It was a little awkward, and Chris Utting could be difficult to work with, and especially Todd, who was young and exuberant about playing bass, and I'll figure it out in a bit. You know, he just learned how to play. He'll figure the song out. If you were a taskmaster with Todd at that point, it would have been kind of useless. He was just learning how to play. Like, he had all the exuberance that you need and all of that, right? And Chris Utting wasn't giving him that chance. There was one rehearsal in particular that I could see Todd. I knew Todd for a few years before this. So I could see, when I saw the look in his eye, like, you back up. Because it's not going to end well for if you're on the other end of the look of that eye. So Chris Utting was kind of in Todd's face, not something you want to ever do. Todd's a good guy. He'll have your back forever. But you don't want to do any of this kind of stuff to him. I think that was done in the basement of your house.
Oh, yeah.
And Todd was nice. He didn't take out this Chris Utting. He just put his fist through the wall right next to his head.
Oh, yeah. I remember that well.
And it was time to get a new drummer. It was time to refigure out this band. So there was an ad. As I remember it, Stone and Regan and guys.
Oh.
We haven't talked about this beforehand, so I'm just going by shit memory.
Yeah. I remember the drummers that came in. Oh, my God. We had some fun ones.
Right.
Before Greg.
Right.
I mean, we had guys, doo-doo-tat, doo-doo-doo-tat, hippie guys with fucking, that ain't going to work.
Right.
Man. And I know Greg's eyes were probably dilated going, who the fuck are these guys? He's like, Greg had everything. He had electronic drums.
I did not.
He had gongs and all this other shit. Yeah, he had Stuart Copeland shit. He was all over it. I mean, it was amazing.
The punk rock was so new, and what we were trying to do was carve a new singular path that we would discover as we went along. There was DOA. There was The Clash.
Yeah.
There was The Germ. There was records we were getting from Southern California and from the East Coast and from England that we, UK subs and you
Sex
know.
Sex Pistols.
Sex Pistols, of course, and The Germs and whatever.
Yeah. I even have some Lewd singles.
Lewd? Oh, yeah. Trash Can Baby?
Yeah. Because I always, in my vision, the Seattle bands were frat boy bands. Like the Cowboys and the Range Hoods and all that safe
bar bands kind of
safe kind of stuff. So I mean, even our band was like, whoa, they were like, whoa, you guys are too extreme, and I don't think we were extreme.
We
at
weren't
all.
That extreme. No.
No, but I think we were.
We really weren't.
But to them, you know, when I saw like Fear at fucking and stuff like that, and then. DOA, I go, DOA, okay. DOA is cool. I was going, okay. But nothing was like that, like radical or anything or, you know.
Scary, dangerous.
Because Seattle just flat out wasn't ready for punk rock at that time.
And Vancouver was kind of the scene that we at least for me, that we looked toward too. So they had DOA, they had the Subhumans, they had the Modernettes, who were this killer fucking pop band. They had really cool, and they had a scene that was, and they had like punk rock houses where you could stay. I mean, DOA was my, basically my Kiss. After Kiss Alive 1, which I got when I was 12, then it was just the Pistols, and then I got the DOA Prisoner single, and like these guys are from around, close to here, but they were, to me, they were huge. The first time I saw them.
When we played a show at Monroe's Dance Palace, and they were the headliners, I think that we tangled. We showed them Duff's head went through the fucking ceiling and shit. And fuck, it was a great show.
That was
show.
A good show for us,
But yeah, DOA's, yeah, they were, I thought, the pinnacle of, I mean, the, because like Fear and stuff, and the Dead Kennedys, they were just kind of far away. They weren't like approachable as DOA was.
So Greg,
can I ask about?
I'm going to run this interview
what was
a little bit.
How did we get? So Greg had an ad in what paper in the Rocket?
It was the Rocket.
Oh, was it the
Do
Rocket?
You remember something that you guys had?
I thought I remember. Oh, we put something up.
Yeah,
right?
Too bad it wasn't the Stranger.
I answered an ad in the Rocket.
We had an ad in the Rocket.
The way I remember it. Yeah.
And do you remember what the verbiage was with the ad?
Man, not at all. No. Okay. What I remember was making my way out. I was not long, had not been in Seattle for what it, I, if we recorded in 82, then we must have met and been playing somewhere in 81. So I had been in Seattle for some months.
Right.
Kind of going to school at the U. And didn't have didn't know anybody here really, friends, not many guys I lived with. Answered Nan the Rocket, made my way out to Laurelhurst, which was foreign new territory to me, and knocked on the door, and this fucking huge guy with blue hair answers.
Dyed my hair. I was in a hair fashion show.
Oh, and I forgot about that.
Yeah, and so I had blue hair, right?
Free hair color,
yeah.
Right?
And so I went swimming in a chlorine pool, and then it turned silver, but it was cool. It was really cool. But you go to Tradewell,
I remember
and
the silver.
Parents would grab their kids like, oh, the disgusting punk rocker.
That moment was, for me, the beginning of everything for me in Seattle. Musically, and yeah. I had instantly a large circle of friends.
Yeah.
Family, basically.
Was this a year before the recording of 1982?
I don't think it was. Things happened so fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In those days.
I think I might have had a slew of songs. Is that right? Todd?
Yes.
Did we work on that?
Yes,
yeah,
we
were
had
a lot of songs.
Greg stuff. So we had that handful of stuff. And then when we got Greg, we moved from my house, my mom's house, to this big, huge 14,000 square foot place on Madison Park.
Capitol Hill.
Yeah, Capitol Hill.
We went there before going to...
Yeah, because we practiced there. We practiced there, before the... Oh, was it before the... Because I know before we went to the studio, we were practicing in that place because we didn't sing. There was no singing. We just practiced to get sharp.
Right.
To get totally solid.
We worked hard.
The way I'm remembering it, the last place that we practiced was at that...
Above Godfather's?
No, at the warehouse.
Yeah, at the warehouse?
Because I'm remembering...
Was that the beginning of the end?
At some point, then, John was gone. And then Jerry Porkface came over once or twice to play. Ooh. And then and we kind of... It just ran out right there.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm just remembering being in that.
Yeah.
We had like a 14,000. We had the whole floor
yeah.
of this empty concrete
wow.
warehouse, and we were. It had a big
service elevator.
Yeah, like you could drive a truck
yeah.
into this elevator in the middle of it. And both ends of the elevator opened, right?
Yeah. yeah.
And we just pulled down the doors on both sides and played inside this big
yeah, it was
box.
Crazy.
In there. But I remember
yes.
just being in there, and Jerry had come and gone, and we were sitting around looking at each
right.
other like, what now?
So rehearsal places back then, too, were a whole different thing, and you guys probably remember this. But Todd's family house was kind of open. Todd's mom was really cool with us kids. Like, she would make food and let us rehearse in the basement at his house. We could come in the back door, but we'd often just come in the front door because his mom would want us to come in the front door.
When I listen to these songs on this record, one thing that strikes me is just how mature the arrangements are in terms of like dynamics and like breaks and drum fill, you know, like
yeah.
they're punk, but they also have all this structure to them and some real like, you know, meaty arrangements and
songs,
you know, and even Greg, I was going to ask you this, just had you played sort of that tempo of stuff before, was that kind of a new range for you in terms of like playing at that speed? Because you sound so natural on all that stuff. I mean, it's just like the drumming is unbelievable. It's just great. But had you been playing in that kind of tempo range?
Well, yeah, but not not that music. That was
yeah.
It was pretty new thing to me, along with everything else.
I mean, you were a King Crimson man. I mean,
but
this had to blow
the, yeah. the also a big a record really key in my development up to that time had been a Deep Purple live record.
Oh,
and they played fast.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, Made in Japan, which is a favorite to by many to mock.
In terms of like the arrangements, were those you basically kind of putting those arrangements together? How were you kind of doing that? What was a little? Can you tell us a little bit about your process of writing songs back then, or how you kind of, you know, got
I had
into
a little
kind
bit
of writing
of a,
songs?
I had a little bit of a head start ahead of Todd, probably a couple years. I would say I was in bands for a
yeah,
couple.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the Veins, I wrote my first ever song, which is called "The Fake," and it's
that
so,
was a great song.
Yeah.
Oh man.
But cool. I didn't know how to write songs, you know, at all. And like, I had Todd. Todd and I were doing two things at once. I was teaching him how to play, and he was reminding me of like the freshness of, the excitement of. Just, I'm going to downstroke the whole fucking set, right? And that's, right, we're both yeah. going to downstroke the whole fucking set. And just that energy was great, and that super influenced riffs. Todd and I know, before Greg came in, we really started exploring, like, those breakdowns, where it'd just be the bass and drums, right? And, like, the right. re-intro thing, or just intros and outros, something we'd never done before. Simple things. I don't think we were copying anybody. We were inventing it as it went. When Greg got in the band, that added this super solid and almost fancy element. Like, we could do anything rhythmically that we wanted to because Greg could.
Greg had, I mean, a plethora of knowledge. I mean, he could play any style. And so having somebody with... That's such a solid. So I go, my game is now to connect with the drummer and be like a fucking anvil. Bam! And so then Duff can play and do what he needs to do. And then the vocals. Because when Duff and I were practicing stuff, there was this crunchy kind of, just like a train going down, locomotive. Kind of sound, you know, boom, 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 very tight, but it wasn't twangy. It was crunchy. Album called Empire, by
Empire.
Yes.
I still have that.
Yes, and I still have it.
Do you guys know that record?
I don't.
That says a lot. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
That record says a lot about. It's the three guys from Generation X, ex Billy Idol, and they made. They were called Empire. The record was called Empire. There's only a few people who really know about this record.
No, they don't, and they're missing out because it is. I go back and I listen to it. I'm going, wow, that album resonated with me more than The Clash, more than anything, because it wasn't mainstream and it was really. I can play this and. And it's great. I mean, basically we were a three-piece band and then you throw a singer in, right?
Yeah.
So to be three-piece has to be tight. You know, because if you have an extra guitar player, you can hide shit. A three-piece, we were tight and I think it shows on the recording. I mean, like I was telling Greg, I go, you guys are the musicians. I just look good.
What shows did you guys play with this with the lineup that's on 1982? Did you play any?
Man, well, one of the best shows that I think we played, it was at this place. I don't know if it was called the Morrison Hotel or something. It was off the Pioneer Square, but probably one of the best shows that I ever experienced. And when we played Ballroom Blitz, fucking place of rap.
Is that fun. What you called our singer? The hall monitor?
Yes, I did.
Can we talk about John? I mean, and we can, you know, either use a little bit of this or not, but I'm just curious about, I know that there's been some, you know, difficulty in the communication and stuff, but
God, he's political. That was smooth, man.
Wow, nicely played. Nicely played.
Well, I'm just curious about him. I mean, he does such a great. I mean, he sings his ass off on this stuff, and he does a great job.
He's a great singer. He's like most lead singers. They need a pill now and then. Here you go. He was definitely crazy.
Yeah, he had the thing. Like what I've noticed with singers, I didn't really know it then. No. You know, I mean there was Ron Reyes, who we had become friends with, a Black Flag guy. That the Veins, we played with Black Flag at the Washington Hall in '79, and Ron Reyes was fucking crazy, and I thought he was going to kick everybody's ass. And knowing Ron. After that, and now, still to this day, he's the most mild-mannered guy, but he's got something extra, something that snapped. The first time I saw Axl down in L.A. in 84, he was as gnarly as Henry Rollins first time I saw Rollins. Like, scary. You backed up from the stage a couple steps. Like, this guy, I don't know what's going on, but he could explode any moment. And John had some of those elements to him. And so you're going to get with John, he was easy to, you know, like when we first got him in the band, he had been in some other band that wasn't punk rock. So Missing Link, that's, yes. They were kind of like a new wave.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. I'm feeling, well, with Johnny Blattenbari, how hard are you going to get?
Right.
But anyway.
Johnny Vinyl, so they had I'm feeling like a worm, right?
What?
I'm feeling like a worm.
Yeah.
Right. So we got John in the band, and my memory's not super great. I'm not gonna lie to you guys. Like this, the recordings when Greg sent me this stuff, 8 months, 6 months ago, I hadn't heard this stuff since then. I was fucking blown away. I was like, and the mix that Greg put on this, I was like, the bass is killer. I texted Todd. I'm like, the bass is.
I thought he was shitting me.
I was not shitting you. No, the bass is fucking killer. The drums sound amazing, and the songs, some of the lyrics on them, which I will raise my hand, it's my doing, are very sophomoric. You know, it's very, I'm 17.
I think they're perfect.
Yeah.
All these guys, we didn't have any, you know, Todd's family wasn't from money. My family wasn't from money. Greg came up from Gig Hard. We didn't have any, there was no money to be, you know, to get a Gibson guitar or something, like, forget about it. Todd... it's got this Fender bass. I was like, whoa, you got the real like Fender bass. And I was playing through a borrowed guitar of either Kurt Block's or Paul Soldier's. And these guys, for my 17th birthday, they all pitched in, like a dozen people or 15, I don't even know. But they got me this Hamer Special, Johnny Thunder's double cutaway, that I was blown away. I still have a picture of them with the guitar and the birthday cake. And you can see the look on my face. I'm just blown away. I got this little amp, and I think I might have bought it from you, Greg, that Mitchell amp. Or you went with me to find it?
You know, I don't know. I was thinking about that the other day, because I remember you did have one of those, but I also had one, but I don't...
Oh, did you also have one?
I think that was it. Okay. I just also had one.
It was called a Mitchell. It was a combo, and that thing had such a specific sound to it. For sure. It became part of the sound of that. And actually, I used it all the way through 10-minute warning and everything.
MXR distortion pedal? Or
no. What,
did you have a distortion pedal with it, or no. Just it would drive itself?
Yeah, I didn't know about pedals or anything yet.
Yeah.
I first started out with this Mateo that Charlie Marinkovich did some crazy work and put these pickups in it. But then when I got my... my first bass, my black and white one, was a Mateo that was Frankenstein. But then I got this white, because I wanted to be like Sid Vicious really bad, but it came out, it was white on white, and it was a 57 P bass reissue, and wow. I was going, it's fucking beautiful. Now it turned yellow. But I got that at American Music, and I paid cash.
Did you?
Yeah. Fuck, I still have the bass. I love it. It's perfect. I've gone through like four cases though. I don't know what happens to cases, but they just wreck.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for Duff showing me how to play, I mean, I think we played Batman at Roosevelt High for a talent show. Do 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 Batman. But anyway. First song that I ever learned how to play. I didn't play it well, but it was good. I looked good. That's what matters.
But Todd was natural. He was a natural. He'll make fun of himself, you know, but in truth, you either have the thing.
He had the rhythm.
Yeah. His rhythm is incredible. It's great.
Yeah.
Incredible. He had a great right arm, right hand.
And the fire.
And he worked hard at it. You know, it wasn't like he was fucking around. And the band worked hard. When Todd and these guys were saying, you know, you were saying we were up there and we just rehearsed.
Yeah, we would practice forever.
Yeah.
I mean, the time would go by, it'd be daylight. Next thing you know, it's like 11 o'clock and we've been sitting there. We wanted to play.
Yeah.
We put the time in.
We wanted to be.
And that was with a singer or without a singer? Was that
just
the three?
No, when we were
guys?
Getting ready to go in the studio, it was boom. We played all the songs, every song. All the time without singing, so you weren't waiting for the cue from the singer. You just knew right when you were to come in. The timing had to be impeccable every time. And
so John was kind of, he wasn't going to so many rehearsals at that point. He was
no, he was there. He was a bystander. Yeah. I mean, he wanted to be the guitar player really badly, but that was... Yeah.
He'd bring out a guitar. So back to John, he was a good, I mean, there wasn't many singers that could sing a melody then you know, there was none of that kind of thing.
He'd sing from the diaphragm.
But he knew how to sing. He knew how to sing. Yeah, and we were probably too young to appreciate, you know, some of his, ups and downs, you know what I'm saying?
His challenges.
Yeah. And we were just, because we were like, you know, a 8-cylinder, SS Chevelle hot rod going straight. And if you weren't on board, you know, fuck you. So when John wasn't on board sometimes, like he was having some issues, whatever, we couldn't appreciate that. Maybe we'll just slow down for a second and take a look at John. But
We didn't know.
We didn't know.
Who? When you're that young, who do you know that things? I mean, yeah. Because I mean, I feel like I still to this day I've given a lot more than I got back. So, and from his situation, but he could sing. The guy was a singer. He had good stage presence, and he just had some.
I mean, just has such a natural delivery. He can sing, but he's not being overly professional or sort of like he's right. Yeah. I mean, he's feeling it. I mean, he's in there and he's the music's coming through him. He's doing something. But, you know,
and he was
it starts
he
with
was
the arrangements, too. It starts with like these songs that are like animating him and like, you know.
Well, I thought he was a Roger Daltrey kind. Because so you like to fucking swing that fucking microphone now and then. And, of course, somebody would get hit with it. Boom.
So Todd hasn't really changed. Todd was, you can tell by his personality, magnetic personality. Either way, whether you liked it or didn't like it, he was going to be him.
That's right.
John, was great on stage, figured it out, and we just all figured it out together.
That's right.
And I wanted to be like the new, if I look back now, and I remember thinking this then, I wanted to be the new DOA. I wanted to be something more. There was Empire, like Todd said, like a band that we.
You got to check that out.
You know, I'd recorded, I think, with the Veins, three songs. I recorded drums with the Fastbacks on two or three songs. Greg knew a thing or two about recording. Like he had a little, you had an 8-track or 4-track reel to reel at home.
Yeah. 4-track.
But all we knew to get ready for recording was just be tight as fuck. John, we probably didn't have a PA too.
No. Well, Chris had the PV in the beginning.
Chris Hutting.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then when that disappeared.
There went the PA.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can't remember if we sang through John's amp.
I think you're right.
Because he had the master man or whatever the fuck thing is.
One day at American Music, 2 days. What was it? 8 hours?
It was the first 5 tunes were a day, an afternoon. I don't know. But we went back to mix, I think. I don't think we walked out with. That I'm not sure about.
No. Then I know it was recording was one day.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And then the last two tunes were recorded by an intern at this studio, the same studio, a week or two or so after. And those I definitely remember going back to mix.
How is it possible that this music didn't get copied and then didn't get passed around at the time.
We all had cassettes.
I had a cassette. And I was like one of the only ones that had one at one time. And I gave it to you so you could have it. But, we didn't have anything. I don't even remember where the live shit came from. I mean, I know that we played a show at the Harvard exit. Did we play a show there?
Yes.
At the movie theater. We played at Harvard Exit, and then we played at the Rex that was the Vogue, and we played there. I can't. But for the life of me, how did it get out? I think we did a radio thing for a college.
So why did it never come out? It was a time of, there was no labels. There was nothing yet. Yeah. If you wanted to put it out, you know, Kurt could put it out, but that was too many songs for a No 3 single. But hardcore came in and to many people's agreeance. You know, just the wrong kids came in from the suburbs and
absolutely.
The guys who used to throw rocks at us for being punk rock faggots, quote unquote, were now coming in and shaving their heads and doing neo-Nazi shit and whatever. And hardcore just ruined. Like the good, like a fun band like Malfunction who were coming to have fun and experiment and do stuff as weirdos. That wasn't accepted anymore, you know?
Correct.
You either play fucking, 1, 2, 3, 4 right now or fuck you, we're going to kick your ass, you know? And not that we had a problem because we were big guys and we had Todd in the band. Like, that was not a problem, getting our ass kicked. We would do the ass kicking, but we had to then.
Yeah.
You know, you had to fight. You had to do all this shit.
I remember.
We were welcomed by DOA, which was a big thing for us. We'd stay at their house in Vancouver, and Todd would steal beer with Joey Shithead.
We used to go into a place with bolt cutters, go into the this big, huge, a driveway, go in there, and there'd be trucks, and we'd just come up, goon cut them, and then run away. I was laughing so hard, I was like pissing my pants, and going, we're gonna get busted, and we're laughing, and we're stealing beer. And Ron from Black Flag was there. He was doing t-shirts, and I was sleeping like a bum with newspaper because they didn't have any place to sleep, so I'm sleeping on the floor on Robson Street, which is now the heroin capital of the world up there. We had a fucking great time.
Yeah.
Oh, man, it was fun. I mean, there was this band called The Wipers. Yeah. And,
from Portland.
Yeah. So they were up there. The Subhumans, DOA. And so these people look bigger than life to me. I was like, this is all fucking, you know, new to me. Just like seeing the Refusers and stuff. They were all older than us.
Right.
So we were just like the young fucking kids on the block. So everybody was older. I mean, even the Fastbacks, they were all older than us. And so it was kind of, we were getting mentored, you know. Nobody really knew what they were doing. Was making up on the fly, you know, pretty much. I mean, the Grey Door, Gorilla Gardens, the Gorilla Room, sneaking in there.
Yeah.
We weren't old enough to be drinking, and we're drinking.
I got busted. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I had to do like
at the Gorilla Room.
Yeah.
There was undercover Vice Squad, whatever they are. You know, alcohol. So yeah, I was so young, drinking in the Gorilla Room. You're not supposed to be there. Yeah. You're supposed to play your show and then leave. Nobody knows about it, really. Regan, you were there. Stone, you came in about 82,
way late.
Right?
Way late. I mean, I didn't get to see the living blood. Not that late. I got to see Tim in a Warning, you know?
Right.
That's pretty good.
Right. To Todd's point about everybody being together, that was a thing then. Like,
totally.
People would share ideas. Like, I didn't know how to play a Steve Jones lead, you know, or Johnny Thunders lead. I learned that from Kurt Block would show me this, or, you know, Slats was a guy from the Silly Killers, kind of renowned in Seattle. He died a few years ago. He never pulled it together and actually got worse and worse. And, back in the day, he was this handsome, gregarious, cool as fuck guitar player.
He was really cool.
Cool. And so you would pick up things like me teaching Todd to play bass or wherever he learned it from. Maybe I showed him the first few things.
No, you showed me how to play.
But that was just the way it was in Seattle then. Everybody would show each other stuff. There was no, if you needed some gear, some other band would loan you. Like, I had a loan guitar for fucking 2 years, you know. No problem, you know. And it was
It wasn't competition. No. We wanted a place to play, because after a while they didn't want to have punk rock shows at this hallway, the VAF or whatever. Sometimes there would be one light bulb and you're playing to this basement filled with punk rock people, you know, people that and it will be an abandoned house or some kind of deal. There was just some crazy stuff going on, but it was so new. That scene was, I don't know, it was just different. But it got evil after a while. I mean, Bremerton folks started rolling in, and, you know, then you got, there would never be grunge without punk rock and heavy metal melting at the Grey Door.
I keep thinking about, you know, the nature of some of those riffs that I'm hearing, and then I heard those kind of in 10 Minute Warning, and then I hear a little bit of what I heard in Guns N' Roses, and it's like, I hear in 1982 the elements of the things that I could hear Paul Soldier doing, or I could hear just getting kind of spread around. So it's like there's so much of the nucleus of what made me so excited about hearing live music in Seattle in this record. That's it. As I listen to it,
that's great.
Like, oh my God, that's like it. Just it sort of foreshadows so much of what ended up being the language that everybody kind of used to, you know, it's groovy, it's heavy, it's fast, but it's slow. I mean, it's like you kind of have all the elements of it. So
it's just one of those things, Stone.
It's really,
it's one of those things where, you know, by me meeting Todd and him like giving me a different angle on playing, like, oh yeah, it's fresh and then Greg coming in and like, oh, this is not that I hadn't played with real drummers, but I didn't really. I had to be the drummer in bands because there wasn't real drummers. I'm not a great drummer, you know? But getting Greg in and like, oh, there's a real hi-hat and there's movement on the hi-hat. He's actually doing, there's something going just with the fucking hi-hat. And then the snare and the kick is this other thing. So I think Todd would probably be on one side of the drum kits looking at Greg's, you know, kick drum. And I'd be on the other side of his kit looking at hi-hat. And somehow that thing created, like Todd said, like it was a tight engine. It was very, we knew like we, would it go any further than our basement? We don't know, but we had something magical then and it was ours. And who gives a fuck, you know? There were so many different players and really good and unique players then and individuals and so much different music to listen to, because we weren't just listening to punk rock. We were listening to The Sweet and Slade, and Greg took me to fucking see King Crimson. We were on mushrooms at the Paramount.
Nice.
And that, you know, Robert Fripp and Adrian Belew and Bruford and Tony Levin. And, you know, we're on mushrooms. I'm like, it's all relatable if it's coming from the heart and coming from the right place. I loved Prince, you know, then.
Oh, man.
I loved soul music and R&B music and we didn't poo-poo Led Zeppelin or anything, you know, because we were punk rock. We were too fresh into it. We were like, this is all fucking cool. AC/DC was cool. They were considered a punk rock band.
You bet. Girls School.
Girls School. Yeah. Motorhead.
Yeah, Motorhead. When we were playing, we were like influenced, like, oh, you stole this from Led Zeppelin or DOA or any of this. It was like we were trying to be us. Trying to be just us, not going, oh, I'm going to sound exactly like Generation X or something like that, which are fabulous. And
I would say that's probably another influence is Generation X.
Yes, they were. Yep. But it was like we weren't trying to be them, you know, like, you know, stuff like that. But there were that certain putting the palm of your hand on the strings and going, you know, man, you can't. Get away from that stuff.
So the first instrument I bought, I had a Seattle Times paper route, and there was this shape.
I had three.
Yeah. So we all had paper routes, right? Yeah. And
mm-hmm. PI and the Times.
There was some shady guy.
Me too, both.
Okay. there was a shady guy who had a bass for sale for $100, $120. It was a Gibson EBO.
Was that little short one that you had?
Yeah.
The foghorn bass?
Yeah.
That was badass.
Yeah.
I thought that was so cool, man.
So that was the first instrument that I could afford to get. And it was electric fucking guitar, you know? I was 12 or 13, and I got that and, like, started to learn how to play. We formed the Veins. But I saw, you know, I saw DOA. And, it, like, if you want to be a bass player, it's fucking Randy Rampage.
You
want to be a drummer, which I became 4 months later.
Chuck Biscuits.
You want to be Chuck Biscuits, man.
Oh, man, Chuck.
You know, you want to play guitar. I mean, really, it was so much DOA. And, I mean, guitar-wise, I went to Johnny Thunder's ALAMF, Steve Jones, full on. You know, those Generation X records, are great. But then this Empire record, which you guys got to listen to, was this. And it was this big open chords, which I didn't really realize he was using a chorus pedal and probably something else on that.
Yeah.
But I just thought his guitar, I want to play that good, you know, but I didn't have effects pedals. So we tried to be that good without knowing how to do it. So you just practice more and more. But it was definitely Thunders, Steve Jones, Randy Rampage, yeah. Chuck Biscuits. Yeah. The Tales of Terror guys would come into the city. I would, like, sit down, you know, with those guys, you know, like, learn a guitar riff, you know. Can you show me how to play that? Or the Personality yeah. Crisis, you remember
yeah.
them?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They would come in, two great guitar players, Richard Duguay and the other guy went to DOA for a while. But I would sit, they would sit, you know, I'd sit down with them and like, can you show me how to play this fucking thing? And you would learn other, you know, I didn't know how to get a guitar. I wasn't going to get a guitar book. I just wanted to learn, like, what did you just play? Yeah. And people were cool enough then in those days.
I didn't
days.
Even know the notes.
Yeah.
It's like, play A, okay.
He didn't know.
Second string down.
Yeah, Todd didn't know the notes. It no. didn't matter.
But it was all hearing, though. You could hear. Yeah. After a while, I'd go, now I can understand a person who plays the trombone.
You know, it was a different time. It was Soviet Russia, nuclear war, and we had this new President Reagan who was kind of more a saber rattler to us at that point. And it's like, mm-hmm. our older brothers had been in Vietnam, you know, like, we're not going to go fight a fucking nuclear war for this fucking actor. You know,
yeah,
fuck
sure.
you. If there's going to be a change, it's got to be us. You know, it's got to be us who make the change, like a new sort of rebel, you know, Minor Threat was doing. The DC bands were doing a bunch of shit, which we kind of knew about, but we were just doing our own thing.
In particular, I remember being somebody's maybe at Todd's house, like seems like there was a party or something, and we went and hid away upstairs in somebody's room and sat there and just right in front of me in as much time as it took to play it, basically wrote, I'm pretty sure it was Live by the Gun.
Okay.
Words of music. Oh, then a thing like this. And then, yeah, four times. Then a thing like this. There we go. One, the you had a, you know, basic melody was part of the,
yeah,
writing the thing on the spot.
And yeah, I think it was all more, kind more of
less,
there.
More or less what John was doing.
But John was, you know, I can't really, I'll just say this, I can't really remember. I know the songs. When Greg sent me the tape, I'm like, oh, fuck. I didn't realize, you know, there was that many songs. And I just remember writing parts, and then what I remember is Todd like writing parts, and Todd would be like, okay, and then he'd go, how about this? And he'd put some like fucking bass thing, like that's fucking genius. And that's where, I mean, Todd makes fun of himself for not knowing how to play and all that kind of shit, and it's just not true, really. Like he was such a valuable component, and Greg coming into the thing just really cemented it all. My wife Susan, like, I've been with her for 24 years, you know, and so when this kind of came, she's like, "Wait, which band was this? Like, what's going on?" I said, "Well, okay, we made a recording a long time." Fuck, you were 12, you know? You know, I was 17. So, you know, now that it's become more, she keeps asking me more questions. So where did you guys play? How'd you guys do it? She didn't come up in punk rock. So to try to explain all of that to mm-hmm, her mm-hmm. It is a little tough, but it's really fun to have this thing. Like you said, the time capsule come out. It was really fun for me. When Greg sent me the SoundCloud of it and I put it on in my car, I'm like, holy fuck, this thing sounds amazing. And the songs were, yeah, it is totally a time capsule. And it's really, yeah. it's really fun that we're doing this 39 years later.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Living 1982 podcast, circle back for weekly episodes and find out about each week's special guests and where to stream the music by following the band's release on Instagram at The Living 1982.